Hello, hello. Welcome back to Brown Game Strong. I am your host, Medali, and this is episode 7, I believe. We have made it this far. But before we actually get into that, can I just say, I have not seen another human being in like 4 weeks, and I swear humans are just not made for that kind of behavior. So yeah, let's just hope we come out of lockdown soon. But yeah, for now, I mean, we're just going to have to rely on FaceTime. And I guess for me, recording episodes is kind of like my therapy. So yeah, I have my outlets, I guess. But I hope you're okay and, you know, keeping okay, keeping well. I'm glad you're here. Glad you're listening, because I feel like at the end of this kind of hour and a half, you are going to be feeling a lot more pumped, a lot more motivated. And just, yeah, I think you're going to feel good. So drum roll, because our guest today is very cool. His name's Akash Mehta. He is the co-founder and CEO of Fable & Mane. It is a hair care and wellness brand based on Ayurveda. And if you follow even a single South Asian influencer, chances are you have probably seen this brand somewhere. And my friend actually messaged me when I announced this episode saying that she just got the oil herself and that it smells amazing. I think oiling my hair has just been such an exciting thing to do in lockdown. Honestly, when I was a kid, oiling my hair with coconut oil was just the most embarrassing thing. I hated the smell. I used to complain to my mom, why are you doing this? You're hurting my head, etc. And now I go into this like zen mode and I'm like, yes, yeah, self-care. I'm going to put on a mask. I'm going to do my, you know, hair oil. But in this episode, we talk about a lot of different stuff. We start off by covering what it was like growing up in the UK for Akash, and he talks quite a bit about colorism, which I think is very interesting, and how it affected him and his life and his perception of the Indian community around him and how that's changed over time. I love that he talks so extensively about his grandma and how this whole company and brand kind of stems from those moments that him and his sister had with their grandma when they were younger, and she would oil their hair and tell them stories. I just think it's so lovely. And it's just, you know what, it makes me want to buy the product, because it's like, I resonate with that. Like, I know what it's like being a kid and having your hair oiled and, like, you know, hearing stories. And what I love about this episode is it's very informational. I mean, if you know Akash, go stalk him now on Instagram. He's got a huge, huge platform. And he shares a lot of tips on how to grow your social media if that's something that you want to do, and also how to take care of yourself when you're working on a company and building a brand. Because, I mean, Akash doesn't just run one brand, he runs three, and he is what you would call a high achiever. And it's not perfect. Things will not be perfect and they won't be polished on the surface. And this takes me back to his experience at university, which we talk about quite a lot because I had a very similar one. We went to the same university, Imperial College. And when I'm talking to him about this, I feel like I'm talking to myself, you know, the kind of learnings that I had from my adversity. And I love how positively he's taken it and sort of almost twisted it into a strength, turned it into his armor, he calls it, and, you know, is using it day to day to kind of build his brand and build his businesses. As confident as he seems on the surface, I feel like there is stuff under there that we uncover that we probably won't see just by looking at social media, right? So anyways, let's go straight into the episode. But if you liked it, please drop me a note, because I'd love to hear from you. I'm so excited for you to hear this conversation. Hello, Akash. Welcome to Brown Game Strong.
Hi, Mitali. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be featured on your podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. It's honestly such an honor to have you on here. I have been kind of stalking your journey over the past, I would say, a few months, but also, like, I knew of you because we went to university together. I think I know of you from East Meets West.
No way.
So, yeah, I know, I haven't told you this, but I think it was the year that you were performing and you were singing.
You know, it's so funny you say that, because I literally the other day, I was just watching the YouTube video of the Chili Bites performance with, you know, where I was on the stage singing. And yeah, I was just thinking about East Meets West, literally like this week. So it's so funny that you said that.
For those of you who don't know, so we went to university together and we didn't actually know each other at the time, but there was a show there that was hosted by the Indian Society called East Meets West, and it was where we all kind of came together and performed and sang and danced. So yeah, that's I think where I kind of knew of you. Yeah, I only put two and two together quite recently when I reached out to you for the podcast. So
yeah. No, it's awesome. But no, it's such a pleasure how A, to connect, and now how it's all like a 360 from Imperial Stays. So, yeah.
I know. Yeah. And I will be asking you more about that. But I want to start off with just tell me a little bit about you, like where you grew up and what it's been like growing up South Asian for you. Do you feel like you were very close to your heritage and your roots?
Great question. Yeah. So I was born in London. So my dad is from Kampala, Uganda. So during the Idi Amin time, you know, they were exiled and he came to London. My mom was born in India, in Pune. But she, with my grandfather, who was her dad, they basically traveled when she was quite young. He was quite close with Osho and was traveling around the world, sort of like, you know, doing a lot of kind of, I guess you could say, inspiring a lot of people around the world, especially in like Japan and Germany. So my mom used to follow him. And so my mom was a bit of a travel-holic, a bit like myself, probably where I get it from. And then they met in London. And yeah, kind of long story short, me and my sister were born. And I was pretty much brought up, I would say, kind of 50-50, like most kind of British Indians. I had very much the connection to our heritage, you know, celebrated all the festivities. And my grandma used to always come from India and, you know, basically educate us as much as possible on Indian culture. But at the same time, I was very much as well quite kind of in depth with the British side of things. So, for example, I didn't learn Hindi or Gujarati that well. I just learned it kind of from hearing, you know, watching the Indian TV serials and hearing my grandma speak. So I would say I'm not as connected to my Indian rituals as more recently, but growing up, but it was definitely there.
Yeah. I mean, so many of us have that double life. And it's actually really interesting that you say that you didn't feel as connected before as you do now. I think I grew up kind of almost like trying to suppress the Indian side of me, but it was purely just because it's like an act of trying to fit in, because I was one of the few Indians in my like school and in my environment. So yeah. I wanted to ask you, did you ever feel like you had to sort of compartmentalize the two, and did you ever feel like they couldn't really mix?
Oddly enough, I think growing up, I definitely had two group of like kind of main friends. I had like a lot of I think organically, most of my friends were not just by coincidence non-Indian, mainly because of my school, etc. But I did have a very much a strong Indian community growing up, mainly through our friends of our parents' children. I think that was like most Indians growing up would kind of know that there's like the family friends. And then there's like your school friends. And usually, sometimes even your school friends, their parents, all the Indians' parents kind of all are friends. So you end up meeting them more regularly out of school. But within the actual school hours, I was more with the sort of, I guess you could say, the non-Indians. So I've always had kind of both sectors, but it's kind of like, this is a very raw telling. But I think growing up, I sort of was more and more kind of leaning towards rebelling against that, just because I was always in situations where, you know, I never saw race as a kind of barrier. I just saw it as a merged line. And a lot of, you know, when you kind of go with many kind of dinner tables with many Indians, it's very much about, you know, only marry within your own sect and only marry Indians and, you know, Indians to Indians. And I was always quite taken back and a little bit, you know, against that, maybe rebelled against that, because I didn't like hearing it. And I felt, why am I forced in a way to marry Indians? Or why am I kind of advised to? And, you know, sometimes on dinner tables, I would hear, oh my God, did you hear this person's going out with a non-Indian? You know, I don't want to say the words, but, and I was always disgusted by it. So I think growing up, I was sort of personally against that. And then the second angle for me, apart from hearing all of that, was also, this is more of a personal story, but I was, you know, growing up, you're always told, you know, fair is lovely, and you had fair and lovely skin, creams. And my mum, actually, she's very, very fair skinned, just naturally. And I have naturally just, my pigment, my melanin is very strong. So I'm a lot darker than my mum. So a lot of the times I would always be told like, oh, you know, you're so dark or you're so tanned. And it was just unfortunate that was sort of like, the idea was, if you're fair, you're beautiful. If you're not, you're not. And I hated hearing that. So I personally felt none of my non-Indian friends, they never ever looked at my skin and said it was too dark. So I always felt comfort also with them, and I felt more secure myself. So those two angles sort of led me to deviate away from that Indian culture because I was so kind of against that. But now as I'm older, and also has, I think society has changed and we're becoming a lot more, you know, aware of this, and we're sticking up to our parents and saying, no, this is not allowed. I'm now becoming more and more back in love with my culture. But that was very, in a raw way, kind of what made me a little bit rebellious growing up, yeah.
It's like coming full circle, really, because it's, I mean, we could do an entire episode on colorism, to be honest. Yeah, but yeah, no, I had the same thing. Like, I would always wonder, why is it that we're always told you can only marry an Indian, you can only marry someone within your community? Why is it that going to the beach is suddenly like, oh, don't get too dark, you know, who's going to marry you? It's kind of just like, okay, it turns into a bit of a joke and you start to kind of not take it seriously and sort of like push your culture away, because that's an aspect of our culture that I think is really good to see that it's changing now, because it was traumatizing as a child to hear these things and almost like feel like, okay, this is just normal.
Yeah. Growing up, I knew it was wrong, but and I was obviously powerless to kind of speak up because a lot of people weren't speaking up compared to today. But I remember, like, if I could go back in time and tell myself, like, I used to sometimes go in the shower with like these scrubs and, you know, always try to get rid of the tan. I used to purposely never go on the beach. And, you know, just because it was always told, I know it's even more so for women, especially because I kept on hearing it to my sister, unfortunately. But even for me, I just felt like, you know, I always was dreaming, if I was a few shades lighter, would I be better looking? And I really hate having thought of that growing up. But it was just, you know, I can't blame myself because that's pretty much what I was told. And it wasn't my parents. My parents have always been very, they've been the best parents. It's more the society, if that makes sense. And yeah. Unfortunately, maybe my parents don't speak up enough for society because what do they know? They've been also raised that way. But they never put that on us. And that was the fortunate thing. And I think I'm very grateful for today is I've had very supportive parents growing up, but it was more the society thing that really got to me. And the sort of understanding when you're in society with your Indian friends is like, you know, yeah, maybe I am at a disadvantage, which I hated. And now, thank God, 360, it's not the case. And we're all educated and we're all grown up and we're all kind of vocal about it. But yeah, growing up, that was definitely a thing.
I honestly wish everybody was educated even today, but I think we are making progress towards it, which is amazing. And like the youth, I think everyone is stepping up and nobody's standing for it anymore. 100%. And and I think it's there's something so empowering about seeing that, like whether it's plastered all over social media or just, you know, big brands now promoting melanin skin. And you know what a time to be alive, really, like being celebrated for our differences.
I mean, you're absolutely right, there's still a long way, it's not a long way, but there's still a way to go. But the start has happened and we're on that journey, and for me that's the most exciting part. And also for my mental kind of personal mind is I haven't had a thought in the last couple of years that my skin is too dark. I haven't. And that for me is the biggest blessing, because I haven't gone to those dark times where, unfortunately, that was what I was thinking a lot growing up. And you know, I don't want to be ever in that position again.
Dark times, quite dark literally.
No
right?
Pun intended.
So you mentioned that you've had a wonderful experience growing up with the parenting that you've had around you. Obviously, we know that you run this incredible brand called Fable in Maine. And I wanted to actually ask you, did you have a lot of entrepreneurial influences in your life from a young age? Was that something that you grew up thinking, yeah, I'm going to be like that too one day?
No, definitely. I think it's been my father. He came literally with that story, which I think is actually true, with £50 in his pocket. You know, Idi Amin time, all his belongings were kept in the airport and they had to come with nothing. They went from living in a big house with their own bedrooms to all the three siblings sharing one room in a small council home. And my dad had to build everything from scratch. And he built, slow by slow, his kind of fragrance empire, I would say, in a way, today. He has offices around the world and he has some of the biggest kind of fragrance brands today. So looking at him, that's always been an inspiration, but mainly his work ethic. You know, I always say to him, oh, you missed that deal. And he goes, look, I'm never going to cheat anyone. I'm going to be myself. And you know, it will always come 360. So him being a humble businessman and kind of being, I think, one of the most honest, has really made me kind of fall in love with the idea of entrepreneurship. But also, I think having that experience as well, because I was always curious about it. So I always used to tell him, could I come to his meetings? Even when I was like 10 years old, he would just always bring me in the room. Sometimes when he deals with even like celebrity fragrances, once he does the Naomi Campbell one, and he brought me when I was like 14 in the room. And he said, first thing he said in the room before even the meeting is, this is my son. He's listening. And, you know, at the end, he would always make me have 5 minutes with whoever it is, the CEO or whatever, and just catch up. So I was so fortunate to have that experience. And I always felt like maybe growing up, like being on a business table, doing business meetings was always like my kind of home. But obviously, yeah, I needed to experience. So he allowed me every summer since I was 13 to do an internship. So I did an internship in all different places, from Warner Brothers to BMW to Airbus, you can name it. And I think without realizing it, he sort of trained me to be my own kind of entrepreneur, kind of businessman. But never ever forced that path on me. So yeah, it was just such an inspiring thing to have that fatherly figure that is not only my mentor but my dad.
So remarkable that you had all those experiences growing up, and it's almost like you were, you know, through those experiences and sitting on that table talking to these people, you were manifesting that into your life and into your future. And obviously, you've worked so hard to get where you are, but I see it as like you were visualizing that for your future. And putting yourself in those shoes that you are in now.
I kid you not, like my dad did engineering, electrical, electronic engineering. I did electrical, electronic engineering, but I had no idea when I started Imperial, that actually my dad did it. Like I didn't even put the two and two together. And then I actually figured it out in the first like semester in uni. And I was like, Dad, wait, you did electrical, electronic engineering. Sad story is that wasn't very good, so he couldn't really help me during my degree, but that's okay. But then he went into business. I think that inspired me that, okay, my dad did engineering, and I knew when I was in engineering that it wasn't for me, but I saw where my dad was today, and I said, that's okay. I can still take what engineering can give me beyond just the you know, the power electronics and the analog and all that kind of stuff, but more about the way it teaches me things, how it trains my brain and mind, and then transfer those skills into any business I want to do. And it just so happens that I did love beauty growing up. My dad's in the beauty industry. So yeah, I pretty much copied his path without realizing it. But then in a way that's inspired me to make it even more successful. Like I feel like I need to make it, I don't know why I feel this, but I feel like I need to do even more and beyond, because he had so much less kind of growing up, and he gave me so much more. So I need to kind of use the gift he gave me and make sure I make him even more proud.
Yes. Yeah. I honestly, I probably echo exactly that, because maybe a few years ago, I used to feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to use my privilege. Like, I feel like there's so many other people who maybe don't have the opportunities that I've had. And like, I need to start from scratch just like everyone else. But actually, if you think about it, like if you kick off from the point that your parents have left you at, or like worked to, and you start from there and you build up from that, there's something so powerful about that, about like owning that privilege and being like, you know what, I'm going to use this for good.
Definitely. And also not taking too much advantage of it, but also how everyone's got, whether they can pinpoint it or they need to still find it, we've all got some form of privilege, and some have got way more than the others, and I'm totally aware of it. And people might be listening and saying, yeah, you know, but for you, you had all of that, and I don't, or not many people do, so it's a bit, life's a bit unfair. And I always say, look, like I personally, I took advantage of what I was able to learn. Like I never ever lost my work ethic and study ethic. So yes, I was maybe given more chances, but it was me who told myself to study until 3 a.m. every day and get my grades. It was me who told me to work super hard in engineering. And it was me who told me, you know, I graduated, all my friends were on six-figure salaries, and I was doing an unpaid internship, and I had to work my way up from an unpaid intern in Estee Lauder to a senior digital manager at Dior. But I did that in 2-3 years, because not because of my dad, but because of what I had to work super hard to get. So yes, it helps open some doors. Also, some doors you can also open yourself, but it's really about making sure that you yourself are doing it, and not just taking advantage. So privilege is important, but it's not everything.
Yeah. It's honestly so easy to judge from a distance if you feel like, oh, you know, I don't have that. Like, obviously it's so easy for this person. But but also, like, I've been to Imperial, so I know, like,
you know,
honestly, yeah, I get it.
How hard it is. And also, like, how even privilege can have its negatives, you know? It can come with extra stress. It can come with sort of a path that's not even yours to choose. Everything is so complicated. But the one thing is making sure no matter what, you do what you love in life. And then if you're on that path, then everything else is secondary.
From your experience at university, you said you did a degree that absolutely, you know, you didn't enjoy as much and you went into something completely different career-wise. What is the one thing you reckon you did learn, though, from that experience?
So the biggest lesson at that time, being I was a very different person at that age, it was I always thought I knew what would make me happy, and that was what's on a paper, your results on an A-level exam, your CV. That was so important to me growing up, and I did everything in my power initially to try to get into Oxbridge and all that kind of stuff. That was like a good couple of years in my life, and I didn't know any better at that point. And there's nothing wrong with that because it's still part of who made me who I am today. So I'm not saying I regret that, but it really did teach me that is more to life than just what's on a paper. You have to really enjoy it. And that's because of my mental health during those times. I was so miserable studying, doing something that, yes, I might get a good name on a paper or whatever, but it's not making me happy. And I realized, you know, it was too late, to be honest. Like, reason why I did engineering was because I was good at math, I was good at physics, two and two together. I thought engineering is good and it's a good degree to have. But in hindsight, I knew in my heart before I started, I didn't even check the courses before I started. I just wanted the name on the CV from a good university. But I knew I couldn't see myself being an engineer for the rest of my life, that wasn't something I could see. So I think because I had that experience and I ended up failing a year and had to retake it because that was a big, big lesson and a big, big, you know, wake up call. I then taught myself, okay, I'm on this path. I chose it, deal with it, fix it, finish it. But now extrapolate not what's on the textbook, but what can I learn from this? And the main things I learned was time management, working in teams, dealing with, you know, tight deadlines, all of those skill sets, honestly, was the biggest blessing from engineering. And I'm very grateful for it because, you know, now today, like those 3 hours sleeping, kind of all nighters and stuff, I was trained to do that for 4 years, and I can continue doing it now, but I'm doing it in what I love, so it's not as hard.
My friends from uni and I joke sometimes that like Imperial taught us how to pull all nighters and like work towards deadlines, and actually sometimes the kind of person I am now is I'm very deadline oriented, so I'll basically chill until like towards the end. And then I'm like, oh my God. And then I start working like a machine. I actually get through because that's how I got through my exams.
We're the same person because I actually realized like I am a last minute person and I work best under pressure. And to be honest, I feel more productive and more efficient doing this. Now, obviously like sometimes, you know, you don't want to like, I think also during university, you know, you had tight deadlines. So I think because we had so many of them, we are trained to make sure we do deliver. But yeah, I love it. And honestly, I'm not going to change because I'm not someone who starts it 3 weeks before and finishes it 2 weeks before. No, I do it last minute. And I love that.
So for everyone listening who is stressed about a deadline, now you know that this way of working also works because I was the same. I was trying to change it for so long. Up until very recently, I was kind of like, I need to be one of those people who starts earlier. Like, why am I starting this 2 days before I have to hand it in? But then I get it done every time and probably at the cost of my mental health, but it gets done. And I think once you recognize that is the way you work, you then start to embrace it. And I think there's nothing better than like really finding what your most efficient way is of working, really.
Totally. And everyone is so different. And, you know, sometimes when you're under pressure, you deliver even more and you don't overthink things and you're not, you know, I would say if I'm working on an essay and I have 3 weeks, if I started 3 weeks ago, I would be spending way too much time on research and not getting to it. But sometimes if you have 3 days, you just sometimes make magic with short times.
So do you make magic on a daily basis now on your company?
I honestly feel like I kind of need to now because there's so many things to juggle. But I also make so many mistakes. But that's the beauty of it. And I think that's what Imperial taught me, my failing of my year. Like, I used to be so ashamed of it. I used to like never want to tell anyone. Now it's like one of the proudest things is failing, which is odd. But that failing equates to me re-finding the right path and not deviating from it. So it was the biggest midlife wake-up call, whatever you want to say, crisis. But I now have learned that I look forward to failures just as much as successes, because a failure for me is an opportunity to grow and become stronger. It's like a, you know, like a, you're building more armor, or you're getting even more stronger. So yeah, every day I feel like, honestly, I wake up, there are so many successes and then there's so many failures. So I actually feel like sometimes my daily life is a bit like a roller coaster or a bit psychotic, where my brain is literally like, okay, that just happened, that's terrible. And then the next minute I'm like, okay, let's move on. Because I can't, I have three businesses today. And if I let one thing affect me, I won't be able to keep on the momentum. So yeah, no, I get a bit of both magic and failures. Both are good.
Would you argue that failure is magic though? I know it sounds cliche that, you know, failure makes you stronger. And like, there's so many motivational quotes out there that say it and everything, but genuinely, like, I have been in your shoes and I know that, like, at the time it felt like it was, everything around me was crashing down. It was almost like everything you ever known about your beliefs and your values has just kind of just gone to dust or something. And you're just like, oh my God, like, I've literally let everyone down, you know, I'm never going to recover. And then you recover and you get stronger. And honestly, there is such an art to dealing with failure. Like, that's what I've learned from my Imperial experience, was there were people around me genuinely who were smashing their exams, like, good on them. You know, I wouldn't probably not have done it like the way that they did. But I have seen that there is very little tolerance for failure when people haven't really experienced it. And if you compare that to people who have, like, yeah, okay, you know, they probably have a lot of self-doubt. But, you know, like that example you gave about something really bad happening at work and you're kind of just like, okay, the next second you just move on. There is an art, I think, to dealing with that. And that only comes from experiencing that. So like, at the time you don't feel it, but later on you're just like, oh my God, I'm so grateful for it.
You hit the nail on the head. It's like, it is cliche. It is, but... it's cliche because, I mean, anything in life is cliche, but I think there are certain failures, of course, that, you know, it's very hard and it does take time. And sometimes it's very hard to even see the productivity of it or the use of it. But it isn't, I always believe everything happens for a reason. It's something I always believe in. But the main thing I say this is because it's more about how you need to tell your mind that it will be a success or you will be stronger. Because if you don't, you're dwelling too much on an action of a past that you cannot change. And instead, you're not focusing on how you can make it better or how you can make yourself stronger. So even if you don't believe it, just make yourself believe it. Because honestly, I always say, like, it's like a heartbreak, or it's like anything. Like, you know, if you fast forward a week, a month, a year, your brain, your mind, your mental state will be so much different. You'll have overcome it, or it will be a distant memory in the past. So if you can kind of fast forward your brain in that moment to say, okay, let's channel that energy in the future, that where I will be. It's a bit psychotic. You've got to like kind of feel like a bit schizophrenic, but turn off or minimize that negativity or that doubt or that kind of, yeah, the sadness you get when you get that failure, and just move on in a productive way. When it comes to business specifically, I know sometimes with personal life and love, you need some time to grow and mourn or whatever, but for business, you got to move quickly and forward, because it's very, very unproductive otherwise. And especially if you're managing a lot of businesses or you're doing a lot of things in a day, you know, the last thing you want to do is you get a failure, you get depressed, you put on the Netflix, you get a popcorn and you just say, that's it for the day. You cannot do that. You've got to move on. And you can't let it affect your other things that are not connected, you know, because so many times I've worked in companies and something happened with a meeting or a pass with my boss, and my boss came to me with such attitude and negativity when I didn't deserve it. Those kind of memories have just taught me this is not the way I want to ever manage my team or manage my business.
I think that's really sound advice. And you, as a business owner and as a CEO, do you ever feel like emotions do still get in the way of your work sometimes? And how do you deal with that?
Only, I would say, with my current business and my sister, which is the Fable and Main one. That one is a little bit hard because I'm obviously, my sister is the co-founder with myself and we're very different personalities, and as normal with any sibling kind of relationship, as much as, and me and my sister, we're best friends and we get along so well, but we are siblings and we do fight and we don't see always eye to eye. That personal kind of approach does get a bit blurred. And, you know, I have to be honest, it's we're not perfect at it and we have a lot more to do and grow from it. But at least I'm mindful of it. So I think it's always okay to be, you know, but I'm a very sensitive person and I don't want to be like, I don't want to be this kind of businessman that doesn't tap into their emotions from time to time, because it can create, again, magic. It can create some beautiful things. So I think it's just being mindful of it. And when are you using that personal or the extra personal approach to your business actions and being sensitive when it's productive or not? And I think once you can figure that out, yeah, then it's going to be all okay. But for me, I kind of keep a little bit of that personal approach with me and my sister, because I want to showcase to everyone that it is a sibling founded brand and we are young siblings. You know, that kind of banter we sometimes have, or that sometimes the rivalry we have, can make it more endearing and more real than inauthentic and a bit stale. So yeah, it's about tapping into it from time to time.
I appreciate that honesty so much. And I think I see that with your brand. Like, it's just, you basically just put yourself out on a platter and being like, this is who we are and this is what we stand for. And I think that that is going to get you places, and it is getting you places, because people want that relatability. Like, if someone were to want to start a business with a family member or a really close friend or a best friend or a partner, like, you know that there's emotions involved. Yeah. There's nothing you can really do about it, but like, how do you navigate that? And also, like, you saying that it's not perfect. I mean, I'm pretty sure nobody has it perfect, especially when, you know, you're so close to the person that you're running this business with. And also with, obviously, with the pandemic, like, we have all pretty much been confined to smaller spaces around, you know, next to people that we're working with constantly. So it can be tough. So I think kudos to you guys for pulling that off and being so honest about it as well.
Yeah, it's tough, but at the same time, it's part of that journey. And yeah, by no means are we perfect on it. There's no actual right formula. It's always changing, and it's about just keep on trying. But as long as you're just being true to yourself, I think that's the most important key message.
So I actually want to go back to, I guess, just at the point where you left university. Now, I know the types of jobs that everybody was applying for at the time. And, you know, it was this weird world where, like, from first year, people were like, okay, career, you know, spring week was it, and then summer internship, and then grad job. And it was all so structured. I felt so overwhelmed personally, also because I come from an entrepreneurial background, just like you, with my family. So what made you tell yourself, no, I'm not doing that, I'm going to go for an unpaid internship?
So I think definitely that failing of the year, well, not only did I lose a year in terms of all my friends were a year ahead, so naturally I didn't have that necessarily that kind of friends competition of, oh, which, you know, did you get Goldman Sachs, did you get Morgan Stanley, all that kind of stuff. But I personally, that was my wake-up call to say, okay, clearly what I'm doing isn't working out for me, no matter what I say or kind of convince myself this is not my path. And I then, honestly, I was, before the second year when I failed, I was on that path of saying, okay, I actually had my applications for like ops and like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and all the banks, you know, because I wanted to get that six-figure salary that everyone was on that path of. And pretty much that's what everyone in engineering was doing, because very few ended up staying in engineering, but most wanted that kind of high roller investment banking job. And I don't know why I wanted that. I just heard everyone saying it. And I was like, yeah, that's probably my path too. But I actually, when I really thought about it, when I failed and I said, okay, I actually was thinking about, what do I want to do? And at that moment, I was like, okay, I don't really want to do engineering, but I don't really know what I want to do yet. So let's finish this degree and let's just see where it goes. But I knew when I said engineering and when I said investment banking, those two things didn't make my kind of, there's whatever you say, there's like butterflies in your tummy. I didn't feel that kind of excitement. So I literally then said, okay, let's finish this degree. And this opportunity came mainly through my dad helping me, saying, look, I have a contact at Estée Lauder. I said, great, you know what? I'm not doing anything right now. I've graduated. I want to just get straight to work, but let's just learn. Let's just do something new. When I started the unpaid internship at Estee Lauder, it was in e-commerce. But at that time, they were hiring a social media manager role. But of course, you know, in these kind of companies, there's quite a big tier system where you have like an intern, then you have like a coordinator, executive, assistant manager, manager. So you're looking at least, you know, 8 years in the company before you become a manager. So I never thought about that role. But then one of my colleagues was really looking out for me at that time at Aveda in Estee Lauder. She was saying to me, by the way, Akash, you've got a really big following on social media. Because at that time I was kind of doing a bit of singing and I had like, I think 150,000 followers from my music and my travel. But I never kind of realized that transferableness of like, oh, this social media following can also be useful for a brand, because I learned how to build my own following organically with very little budget. Could I do the same in a company using my kind of techniques I learned through ads, posting techniques, all that kind of stuff? And could I use that on a brand with also maybe with some budget, but not that much budget, to grow in a similar way? So I think I was one of the first at that time to connect the dots. And then I ended up applying and I said, look, I have no experience, but I have had 5-6 years doing my own Instagram, my own YouTube, my own social media. I know ads. I know all of this stuff. I don't think many people in the industry at that time even knew more than I do. And I said, you know, maybe I would be a good opportunity to try this. And long story short, I was hired as, I think, the youngest ever manager at Estee Lauder companies worldwide at 21, which was really cool. And yeah, that was when my career kind of kickstarted. But again, it was all because of that unpaid internship that got me there.
Wow. It just shows that following the conventional path that everyone else seems to be following is not necessarily always the answer. It's like the biggest thing I believe is you have to carve your own path and you have to like not look around too much, because we all have different strengths and weaknesses. How is it possible that we're all going for the exact same job? Like, obviously not all of us are going to be happy from that. Oh, I'm getting like all these memories from my experience as well coming back now. Actually, funnily enough, I ended up going into one of those conventional jobs. I work in consulting now. Even today, I feel like every single day I'm trying to do something that makes me happy, you know, like genuinely happy. And it might not always be my 9-to-6 job that gives me that happiness. Sometimes it does. Other days probably doesn't fulfill me. That is also a way to do it. It's like, you know, you can go down a conventional route, but you still have to find your why, like your reason for doing it, and also like try and find fulfillment in it.
Definitely. And also like not rushing that, because I personally love my time in Estee Lauder. I was at Burberry as before that, and then Dior. Those experiences were incredible, and I even today I miss them. And there were benefits of those kind of experiences in those companies that I will never have again today. And you know, I do sometimes have those doubts of, you know, what would life be like if I stayed at Dior and all that kind of things. But I really did exhaust. I worked on Fable & Main with my sister about 8 months while I was still at Dior, working in any break I could during lunch. And then after work, I would work until 2 a.m. So, I got quite exhausted in that way. But at the same time, I waited to the moment where I was like, okay, I really can't do both. And this one is now the sure yes. And this is happening. Fable & Main is going to launch. Let's now quit, as it's no longer a dream, it's a reality, and let's go for it. But, there's nothing wrong with trying to do both, or, you know, doing the corporate kind of conventional thing and then also figuring out what's your why. And your why or your future might always be there, because there's nothing wrong with it. And it's not everyone should or needs to create their own company. But for me, it was, I'm glad that I didn't rush it. And I never had, when I was at Dior, when I joined, I never wanted to create my own company. It just came organically through something that with my sister, we were saying, we need to create this product, let's do it. But actually, I could have seen myself for 5-6 years there as well. So I didn't kind of create it, it came to me. You shouldn't necessarily fabricate it. And a lot of these entrepreneurs, they sit and they say, "What? Let's find the gap in the market. Let's create it. Let's make it Instagrammable, and it's going to make money." And I said, no. You can do that. And it could work, but try to wait for an authentic, true reason. It will come to you organically, and then build on that. Because when you have a true story and a true kind of start and origin of it, it would not need as much marketing. It would not need as much budget. It will just grow on its own. It's going to, you know, truly resonate with people.
That's so beautiful. I want to know a bit more about how this idea came about for Fable & Main. So you said it came organically to you, but what was your thought process and how did you take the first few steps towards it?
So this kind of goes back to our beginning of our kind of conversation, because it was kind of, you know, I did lose touch of our culture. And me and my sister, we actually were together, we were like just talking about the fact that we really are, unfortunately, all our grandparents have passed. And my nanny, especially, I was very, very, very close to. So she used to, growing up, come from India, bring these incredible like Ayurvedic plant roots and oils, and then massage them into our hair while telling us like these really cool fables of like animals that could speak. So like story time and hair care was honestly like a weekly, if not a daily ritual growing up, especially in summer when our grandma used to come from India. So I had like, when my, during my time at Dior, actually, the last grandma, she passed away, and I was very, very close to her. And I think I really missed them a lot. And from missing them, I realized all those memories growing up kind of came back. And I really missed our culture and those memories of like, why don't we do this anymore? Why don't we oil our hair? And my sister had a story where her hair was falling out. So there was also another need of like, we need these products again. But there was nothing in the market. Like, we looked left, right, and center. I used to work for Aveda, which was an Ayurvedic hair care brand inspired. And they completely went in the other path. They had products called Cherry Blossom and Sap Moss. And this wasn't Ayurvedic anymore. And I realized, no. There isn't a brand yet, especially a mainstream brand in like the Sephora's and in the, you know, in the Selfridges that have Ayurvedic Indian wisdom. And then I looked further and I was kind of getting annoyed that you have K-beauty, you have all these like J-beauty, but what about I-beauty? What about Indian beauty? Like, not only just hair, but skin, like all these amazing ingredients coming from this 5,000-year-old science of Ayurveda. And no one really knows, like none of my friends oil their hair. So I felt also another mission to bring and represent, you know, the South Asian community and what we all knew about growing up, that I want everyone to experience, no matter if you're South Asian, everyone should oil their hair or, you know, try these ashwagandha, dashmul, these potent plant roots. So that was the mission. So it came from not only childhood memories, but also a revisit to the past and the need to sort of bring back the memories of our grandma.
Oh, it's such a nice tribute to her as well, isn't it? Like, she would be so proud if she saw all the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the hardest thing today, is like not having her necessarily see all of it. But at the same time, it's sort of like, I'm hoping somewhere in the universe and somewhere, you know, she is seeing it. But it also makes me, the more and more I work on it and build it, the more and more I remember her and I feel closer to her. So that's also why I work day and night, is because it's like my memory of her in a way. It's weird, but yeah.
I want to ask you a little bit about cultural appropriation. So yeah. Obviously your brand is so rooted in Indian culture and everything that you've learned from your grandma. Do you see a lot of other brands out there kind of almost appropriating the culture and, like you said, like maybe renaming it or sort of deviating away from the original mission? And how does that make you feel? Like, how are you trying to defy that with your brand, Fable & Main?
Number one thing with me is I'm the least confrontational person. So I usually try to act quite naive with things like this. So whenever I hear like something controversial or appropriating, I always try to find the positives in it and not the negatives. And I feel like that's actually a good approach to have, because I think today, and you know, look at social media, where it's very easy to cancel and call out cultural appropriation. And I had this when I was at Dior a lot, with like a lot of the things we did had a lot of backlash, but honestly the intention was never that. Sometimes it was an homage, sometimes it was like we want to give awareness to it, but also show that we're moving forward. It is hard, and it's a very hard balance, because everyone can have an opinion on it. So I haven't necessarily focused too much on looking at the brands that are doing it in a culturally appropriating way. I will say, like, brands that stem from something in the past, I always feel it's of the greater good of bringing those memories and showcasing it to the world. So I always see it as a positive. But of course, like, it is true in saying that we have to find that balance. Even for us, like, I might have people saying about our brand that, you know, we're not selling in India, but we're, because of Corona, we can't right now. It's been a bit of a nightmare, but you know, we're using Ayurvedic Indian wisdom. And there's a lot of things that you could say that our brand does that could be perceived as like we're deviating because we're bringing modern and new formulas together. But I think that's a beautiful thing. I think we're taking inspiration, but we're also paving the path forward and using the new techniques that we have For example, you could argue some certain things that, this was an Ayurvedic formula, but necessarily wasn't good for the planet. But now we have newer techniques that you can find turmeric in a sustainable way, let's say, right? These are examples where you're not really necessarily, you're changing, but you're also going in a more ethical and forward way. From a cultural appropriation part, to go back to the main point though, my honest answer is I haven't seen much currently with Indian culture. I try to focus a little bit more on the fact that they're paving the light forward. We have to respect those traditions and we have to pay, I have to be mindful of it, but also there is some good in changing things as well, because we make it much more, as the world is changing, we have to. And today, I'll give you an example. If tomorrow I have a child and my child wants to, at 5 years old, change sex, I won't be, my grandma might be like, no way, this is ridiculous. I remember my grandma growing up, when you even heard the word chicken, she would be like, no chicken. Why are you saying chicken? And now it's like, I would want my child to be vegan or vegetarian, but everyone's to their own now. And, I'm a lot more open than I was growing up. And I think everyone should be, regardless of culture necessarily.
Yeah, adapting to the times, definitely. Cultural appropriation, I think, is just like a whole can of worms again, because, there's just so many different opinions around it. But I think ultimately, and I feel like you're also saying this, is that like if it's done in the right way with the right amount of respect and, paying a tribute to where it's come from, then it is something to celebrate, because more people learning about our culture can't be a bad thing.
And I say an example. So luckily with Fable and Maine, we are, I guess you could say fortunately, we haven't had any backlash as a way, because we are Indian founders and the story is very true. But at the same time, if tomorrow some non-Indians would create an Indian brand, I wouldn't feel at all threatened or culture appropriated. So looking at the likes of, say, Tatcha, Vicky Tsai, who has created a Japanese skincare brand, but she's Korean. You look at Moroccan Oil, which was created in Tel Aviv. Some of the greatest brands today are not necessarily rooted in the right, what people would say, traditional, culture. But at the same time, look at that. Like Tatcha has really brought Japanese wisdom to the world in a way that no other skincare brand has really done in the USA. And if we focused on, she's got a lot of backlash because she's Korean, but if we just focus on that, we're missing the benefit of the fact that she's also brought amazing products to the market that no one has done necessarily.
This is a huge side note, but I've just made a note of Tatcha because I've actually listened to a podcast with Vicky Tsai in it, and I found it so incredible, her story. So yeah. I'm just going to, take a note of that. I want to move on to social media. Your Instagram is just popping. I look at it and I'm just like, how does he do all of this? Like, how do you have the time? How much time do you spend a day, curating your feed? If you don't mind me asking, of course, because I'm sure a lot of people are wondering this. And also, how come you know so many influencers? Because I've seen basically every South Asian influencer on my feed promoting Fable and Maine, which is incredible. But I'm just like, wow, like you guys have done such an incredible job with putting your brand out there and putting the name out there and rightfully, teaching everyone about Ayurveda and the ingredients in it and the benefits that it provides. So talk to me a little bit about that and feel free to share any secrets, because I'd love to know.
So I'll be first transparent and say I feel I'm the worst at social media right now, maybe compared to my three-year-old before self. But I used to do the whole curation of my feed and really care about each post and post daily and, regularly. Now, honestly, I have three businesses, but the time I can spend on my social media is quite minimal, and on my phone as well. I don't really have a rule book anymore. Sometimes I'll post twice a day. Sometimes I'll post once every 2 months. And honestly, I only post in my feed probably once a month now. It's quite bad. And maybe it's becoming a bit too Fable and Maine. I need to bring back that personal life. But I personally don't really have the best techniques anymore. I would say I need to start looking at people to get a bit better at it now, because I've definitely lost my social media kind of marketing skills there. But I think that's also, for me, I'm happy about it because I want to just make it really organic, authentic. I don't care about my numbers anymore. I don't care about a million followers or less. I've been on the same following for probably like 3-4 months. I'm losing followers just as much as I'm gaining followers. It's been stagnant and it doesn't stop me from still just posting what I want. But I think the good thing is like, I'm trying to find that balance of now, instead of growing my account, how do I connect more with my current followers? Because I spent a lot of time growing it without necessarily talking to them. And I realized this year that I didn't know my followers well enough. I didn't know if they followed me because of my travel, because of my music, because of my Dior. I didn't know. And I spent this year, first I offered some consultations to my followers. I did about, 30 consultations for an hour, just like free digital consultations, helping them with their business, their career, whatever. And then I offered a digital course called Digital with the Cash. And it was a 2-month course every Friday for an hour. It was a live stream course and it was free. And it was talking everything about Google Analytics, SEO. And you can find it on YouTube right now. But the live streams I had about 8,000 signups in the first few hours. I was talking to them and people wanted to know more about my brand building and my career and education. And this is where I said, okay, my main thing as an influencer or person of influence is I want to help people learn about career, how to navigate post-university, how to build a brand, how to grow in a corporate company. That's sort of my thing now. And I realized that's what I love talking about and doing. So I will be launching a YouTube channel soon, basically just being open about that, spreading tips on how to build a CV, how to get a job at Dior and all that kind of stuff, because that's the stuff I think people would love to know now. But in terms of my influencers, so I was fortunate when I was at Dior, my job was, I was pretty much in charge of influencers. There was a PR team as well. So I was more on the marketing side and I got to meet pretty much most of the beauty influencers around the world when I was there. I was there for 3 years, so quite a long time. And I got to become very friendly with pretty much most of them, if not all of them. So that was very lucky. And I think that allowed me to like have very good friends as influencers. And then the South Asian part, that just grew a lot more over the last year, because I think I suddenly started seeing how many South Asians were supporting each other. Like, I was shocked to see all of the South Asian influencers were posting for free, no payment, about Fable and Maine. They were just all like from Kaushal to Deepika to, Deepa Khosla, all these influencers, I can name so many. They were so just nice and wanted to support South Asian businesses. So that was, I think, the last 4 or 5 months, I've been so overwhelmed by that. And for example, one little anecdote, but I was watching this Netflix show, Never Have I Ever. And it was the Mindy Kaling Netflix show. And the cast, they like Richa Marjani and Purna, they basically messaged me and then I sent them some products and they did a feed post for free, said this is the perfect Diwali box. And I was like overwhelmed to say, wow, I just watched this Netflix show. Never thought in my life I would ever talk to these actors and actresses. And here they are messaging us. And I thought, yeah, that's really cool to see the brand bringing together the South Asian influencers and people.
That's literally giving me goosebumps, just like the fact that people are reaching out to you and it's almost like right after you've seen the show, the cast are messaging you. It sounds like a dream, but it's also like, it's a testament to how true you are to your brand. And of course, like, you know, the whole journey you've had up until now and also the experiences that you've gained as a child and, you know, probably also through your family and everything. But it's just, I think I see that as the purest example of like taking what you've been given and making something out of it. And it probably also is the fact that I've personally not seen a hair oil like yours out there. Definitely in terms of the story and the brand, like from the actual name of the brand, it just seems like it just oozes authenticity, which is what people want really. And it's almost like you've touched their heart basically, which is why they've reached out to you. So it's so nice to see that. And I think that it's also very, very motivating to know that, you know, if you are sticking to what you believe in and not trying to be like someone else, you will attract the right kind of energy. Well, I kind of want to ask you, just off the topic of social media, if someone wants to grow their page, for example, what do you think they should focus on? Because I feel like Instagram is such a saturated place right now. There's just so much of everything. It's overwhelming. So like, how would you, if you were to start, you know, your page again, what would you do differently? And what advice would you want to give someone like that?
So I would say there's two ways, and not necessarily, I always say the second way I'm going to say is the better way, but again, no right and wrong always in life. But the first way is like, yeah, you can grow quickly by kind of doing the whole Instagram hacking idea of what works, what content works. So, you know, we all know these like viral reels of like, you know, doing these kind of TikTok-y videos works really well. So, you know, you can create a plan of action of this. And that's what most influencers actually do today is they literally create content knowing that it will go viral or people will share it and click it. But again, it might not be really their authentic selves. They're, you know, maybe that's not their message. They want to be long-term. So I would say if your goal is to get followers quick, that's not a bad way. You know, look at what content works, test, trial, try different things. Archive posts that don't work and continue posting the ones that do work and look at your engagements and then message people, comment on people's posts, do giveaways, all that kind of stuff. It can really help. This is what I did 3-4 years ago, but now I really don't have time for it. And I think I want to grow more sustainably. So what I do instead and what I always recommend to people is first, you know, your existing audience, whether it's your friends, family, whether it's, you know, the following you currently have, first spend the time understanding what do they want from you. And what do they enjoy seeing? So I do a lot of polls. I basically do a lot of conversations. I reply to most of my DMs. And this is the way to like kind of connect first. Once you understand that, then let them dictate what you should create more of. And do it, I like to do it without thinking about engagement, without thinking about the likes and comments. Just post as you will. And I always say, then if you do get a viral video or you get a moment where it all blows up, everyone will then look at the past and what you posted. And if it's that true, authentic message of you, you're going to get not only the right people following you, but you're going to get the right path that you want to be on without you being stuck to say, wow, I've built my audience because people love seeing a 5-second video of me dancing, but I'm not a dancer. I don't want to be a dancer. I want to be a businessman or whatever, right? So this is what I would recommend. So the first is not wrong. And it's maybe the quick way. And sometimes the quick way is a good way because it gets the job done quicker. But try to focus on the second and grow sustainably and figure out your why first on social media. But the great thing is with social media, you could be whatever you want. You could be a social media. You can grow your social media presence being a baker, being a whatever. You can be a dancer, anything. It doesn't matter because people always want to follow you if you have something interesting to say.
I think that's incredible advice. And I mean, lockdown has been a time of unfollowing. I think everybody has, you know, re-evaluated who they're looking at on their feed. I've personally done a lot more unfollowing than I have following during this time. And it's just because, you know, for my mental health and everything. So actually it can be quite a difficult time if you're trying to grow your brand and like on, you know, on social media. But at the same time, I've also found some incredible accounts that I really resonated with. And it's not because of that one viral video. Like, yeah, maybe I found it because of that one video, but it's because of all the other amazing content that you find once you get on there. So it's just ultimately like just staying true to yourself as well, right? Doing things you enjoy rather than trying to do what you think other people will enjoy that doesn't come naturally to you.
Definitely. Couldn't agree more. That's exactly how I feel. And I think also it's about like for you, what do you, for example, put as the most important, like when you unfollowed people and now you're following people for your mental health as well, what do you look for in content that you would say inspires you today?
I look for authenticity. I read captions a lot. So for me, it's a lot about like, okay, how much can I connect with this person's personality? Recently, I've been really into like short videos, so like reels and TikToks, because they're so easy to both consume and create. But I think ultimately, it's just seeing people that inspire me in whatever way it is. You know, if they're representing the South Asian community, like more power to them. And I want to see more of that. But also at the same time, like, I don't think just because you followed someone at one point of time doesn't necessarily mean you'll resonate with them for years to come. It might be that you're, you know, only just following their journey for a little while you're in a certain mental state. So it really depends on a lot of factors. But in terms of my own posting, I honestly just do whatever. I don't plan it. It's just like, okay, today I feel like doing a dance. I really like this song. Okay, let's just do it.
It's important, I think, to just be as authentic as you, right? Because there's no kind of, it's not curated. It's curated, but curated around you, you know, not created for Instagram.
I saw you on the list of Forbes 30 Under 30 last year. Is that correct?
Yep.
Tell me what that was like. Was that a goal for you always, or did it sort of, did you stumble upon it?
Yeah, so that was, it was definitely, I will be honest, it was definitely a goal of mine growing up. I always wanted to, since I knew what it was, I was always like, that would be a dream, this Forbes 30 Under 30. But I never thought I would get it during my time at Dior, because I always thought, you know, people, Forbes especially, people want to reward these kind of accolades to people who've created their own company or people who've done something more entrepreneurial. I thought, you know, I've never really heard anyone get it when they're at a corporate company. So I never had it in my mind, but I was working with a lot of agencies, and I think I was, in a way, if I could say, pioneering a bit of like luxury beauties, influencer marketing that wasn't done like 3-4 years ago, working with people, like gifting products to people of 3,000 followers and making communities and growing the sales of Dior in this way and the earned media value. I created this account called Dior Beauty Lovers, which was the largest regram account, for a dedicated regram account for any brand in the world, that was just purposely regramming community. So these are the kind of things where a lot of agencies were seeing me doing it, and they were like, wait, you know, this is quite entrepreneurial within a big company like Dior, which actually, if I may say so, is actually harder to execute because you've got such heritage and you have to like really like, you know, convince the seniors that this is a decision to do, because it's a big move for Dior, who used to always say, you know, we're Dior, we're luxury, we never gift, you know, no discount, all that kind of stuff. So I was like trying to educate them to say, this is not discounting, this is not gifting, this is like really becoming closer. Can we create a glossier effect, but with a luxury brand? And long story short, a few agencies recommended me. I then got a reply. I got like an email from Forbes being like, you know, you've been shortlisted. Can you fill out more information? This was like 4 or 5 months before they announced it. And I filled it out, didn't think anything of it. Thought, okay, they probably have so many steps and everything. And then on the day where they announced it, I obviously got a lot of news articles about it. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I didn't get it. Obviously, I didn't get it, so that's fine. And then I was just walking to work and I was like, let me just check who is on that list. And I checked it and I saw my name and I was like, wait, what? How is my name on this list? I didn't even get an email. I didn't even get told about it. So I literally went back home, went into the living room and I started like dancing. I was like, oh my God, yes. I was very excited. And then I was like, okay, breathe. I called my dad, called my mom, my sister, and then I went back to work. And then it was funny because in France, I guess no one really cares about these things. So I went to the office and everyone was like, what's Forbes 30 to 30? And I was like, okay, no. So that's fine. So that kind of made me feel like, okay, this isn't a big deal. And then I got the emails from Forbes and stuff. They sent it a bit later saying congratulations. And yeah, it was definitely one of the proudest moments of my life. I think mainly because secretly, it was also really kind of relieving for me, because it made me realize that maybe, you know, you do all this work in a big company and you end up not really, no one but the company itself knows what you've done. And then when you leave, it's sort of like forgotten history. So this was kind of like a stamp to say, wow, my work at Dior has been recognized. It's forever on Forbes.com. And now I can like leave and do something else, because I felt like I've got my seal of approval, which is silly because we shouldn't need that stuff. But when you work really hard for a company that's not yours, it's sometimes nice to get that recognition.
It's like, you know, with awards, everyone's like, oh yeah, we don't really care about the award, but secretly you do.
It makes you feel like, you know, you can always get that little self-doubt, and it makes you feel like you've done something right, which I think was very important for me at that time.
Yeah, I think anytime you get self-doubt now, you can just go on Forbes.com and be like, nope, I'm not doing that today. So I want to move on to the last part of today's episode, which is around wellness. And I know you're so big on wellness. I want to know, how do you take care of yourself?
So I definitely make sure, no matter what, every day I have to do some sort of physical exercise, whether that's running or whether it's cycling, like on my Peloton bike, or doing gym. Recently, I'm more into the lifting weights and the gym part, because I think it's very good for my body and it gives me kind of, not only keeps me fit, but also mentally. So I have to do that every day, whether it's an hour. I used to, maybe during lockdown before the first one, I was really into it. I was doing maybe 3 hours a day, which is a bit stupid. But now I do like 1 hour at least. And that keeps me really grounded. But I do interchange that with yoga. So I'm not religious as I was before with yoga, but I do maybe 2 times a week, a little flow exercise on my own. I also sometimes, when I need to in the day, just meditate, very, very short meditations, like 5-minute breaks. that's just, but my way is my own way. It's not really a rule book. I just close my eyes, go deep into a deep thought, and then kind of like wake up again. And that kind of keeps me very kind of grounded and focused. But the main thing is the physical exercise. I need to do it every day. If I don't, I don't feel like my day is accomplished. And I haven't given that sense of time to myself, my own personal self, and my own body, which I think is very important.
Do you physically think like it makes a difference in how you operate at work?
Definitely. I mean, I definitely have more energy. Like, I think obviously forget the science part, which is a whole separate conversation, but having a healthy diet and a healthy exercise of routine not only makes you stronger when it comes to physical health with like, say, let's say getting ill, I get ill way less. I'm a lot more healthier. I don't have headaches and colds and flus because I'm taking care of my immune system by being healthier. But also I just have more energy in the day. It keeps me active, energized. And also it also keeps me having that break. So I have like a break in between work. So I'm not necessarily always on my laptop. So yeah, it definitely does help. And I think without it, I would probably be a bit more slower, a bit more lethargic and not as active, which I think I need to do when I'm working my hours, which I kind of currently do. I work pretty much until 2 a.m. every day, so I need to have that exercise.
I really want to know how to crack this because I've not done a proper HIIT workout in what seems like months. My only way of exercising is dance, and it's because it gives my soul joy. But yeah. How on earth do you balance that out with, you know, working till 2 a.m. every day? Do you never feel like, oh, you know what, today's a really busy day, I don't have time to work out?
No, I mean, to be honest, okay, I do get days like today. I haven't done it yet, but I'll try it after this. I'll go on a quick Peloton cycle. I have trained my brain now to be quite strict on it because I see the benefit of it, and I also enjoy it. The hard part is if I do lack a bit of like the discipline, I have 2-3 days where I'm a bit lazy, then it's hard to get back into it. How I do it is I first tried to figure out a few years ago, what do I enjoy doing? So I used to hate running. I used to like pretend at school I was ill and never run. Then I forced myself to do a marathon. And by training for a marathon, I ended up being like, I actually like running because you hate it when it's hard and when it's a struggle. But when you end up doing like a 5K run every other day and you start going to 10Ks, it becomes a lot easier. And you end up, not only do you, when you go on a long run and you don't find it that difficult, you also end up enjoying it. Same with going to the gym. Like right now, I have to be honest, I haven't been to the gym regularly, well, mainly because of lockdown, but I've been doing more like cycling and stuff like this. So I was just lifting the weights the other days and I've lost all everything. I've lost my muscle mass and it was so hard to get back into it. But I know if I can keep consistent and I do it maybe a few more sessions, I'll start getting back into it. I'll start finding it easier and I'll start loving it again. But I do know what I don't enjoy doing. So for example, I know I don't enjoy cycling outdoors. I like cycling indoors. I know I don't like necessarily I like, for example, swimming, but I don't like maybe running as much. So I try to figure out what I enjoy doing and do more of that. And I think that's important. So maybe for you, I would say like, it's not always about HIIT. Like, I mean, I personally don't always enjoy the Barre boot camps, but sometimes it's fun. But I would say figure out what is that. Dance is it? So dance is definitely one of the most best ways to exercise. But let's say you want to do a couple more things and kind of have some kind of flexibility and change, maybe figure out one or two more things that you really enjoy doing and add that into your routine. So I, for example, I gym, but I also cycle and I also do tennis. So I found my three things that I really like.
Yeah. I think it's the routine that's the key part actually, because yeah. I don't really have one. As I said, I'm very ad hoc. Like I'll only do it if I feel like it. And that's obviously not very often. Before lockdown I used to do cycle, which for anyone cycle. Who doesn't know, so it's like the British version of Soul Cycle, but I absolutely loved cycle because it just made me feel so good about myself by the end of it. I was just like, yes, I am a queen, I am so empowered to do everything that I set my mind to.
You should get a Peloton bike. I used to go to spin studios probably 3 times a week in Paris to a place called Dynamo. And I used to go to cycle all the time. I'm one rebel in all these places in the UK and Soul Cycle every time in New York. I love it. But I got the Peloton bike and I was always like, you know what? It's not going to be the same as a studio with the music and the energy and the instructor. But I kid you not, I now literally dance on the bike the same as I am in the studio at home, probably looking like a right fool, but there's no one here to watch me, and you really get into it. But the best part is you can do it at any time. Like I can go right now and do a class. I don't have to worry about going to the studio. So, you know, sometimes, yeah, investing in things like this can really help. And also when you end up paying a lot for it a month, you have to end up using it. So that also helps as well. Kind of like a gym membership, right? But during lockdown, yeah, we've got to be creative and we've got to figure out new ways of exercising at home.
That's exactly it. And it is also like the price factor, I think, because it is quite, Pelotons aren't cheap. But yeah, I think if it is something that you enjoy and like you find it to be worth it, then it is an investment at the end of the day. And like, what could be a better investment than investing in your health, I feel. So I
couldn't agree more. No, I love that.
I want to ask you, like, also, what does a typical work day look like for you? Do you have a lot of meetings? Do you have control over your schedule?
So it's kind of a mix of, I have a lot of meetings, a lot. That's why my 9 to 6 p.m. is pretty much not the most productive in work, but the most productive in meetings. And then kind of in a way, creating new work and creating new businesses and progressing in that way. But that's why I have to usually work until late, because I have not the time to create those PowerPoints, reply to those emails, etc. But I would say, like, I don't really have now, I have a routine in some way where I wake up, if I can, I'll do my exercise. If not, I'll do it later in the day. Depends on my morning meetings. I usually wake up quite early, I would say. I always wake up at, early in terms of when I sleep late. I used to wake up at 7, now I wake up at like 8 because I'm sleeping at like 2, 3. But by 9, I'm on my desk working, start my meetings. I always do check-ins with my team. I have three different businesses and I have like about 13 employees I've got to manage directly. So I have to like do these different calls and Zoom calls. Zoom is my best friend right now because I don't have the office currently. And yeah, I just basically kind of have some plan and then the rest is just coming bit by bit as the day goes on. And then my best time of the day is like at 6-7 p.m. when the emails have kind of settled down and I can like go into my routine of like going back into like kind of actioning all the work. But I'm not gonna lie, I do sometimes have, say, Game of Thrones watching in the background, where I play a bit of like some Among Us video games or something. Like I do El Buraco on my card game online. I try to find like some little things to also make me enjoy the evenings as well and something to look forward to. But yeah, I'm such a grandpa. I don't really do much more than that. But to be honest, I said this in an Instagram story today to my audience, because I got a lot of people messaging me saying, oh, you work so hard. Is it, do you get overworked? And I even saw someone said, I don't think it was directed at me, but someone said on their story, it's so exhausting to see people kind of bringing like or showcasing that overworking is a good thing, that like we shouldn't be glorifying it. And I was like, oh, I completely understand where that's coming from. And I would never, and that's the thing, you know, when you said you look exhausted looking at people's story, people could be looking at my story and be like, okay, gosh, it's so demotivating to see someone work all the time. Like I'm not working that much, working out. And I always say, you know, like number one thing for me is like, you know, everyone's on their own path and there's no right or wrong. I definitely get days where I also just sit and do nothing and eat popcorn and literally feel like I'm doing nothing with my life. I have that regularly, honestly, and I feel really bad. Next day, I try to motivate myself again. But the most important is, like I said this in my story, I don't feel I'm working because I love working. And for me, I have more joy now going on my laptop, doing my businesses, working on it, training my team, then going on a dinner with my friend. And that's just the path I'm on right now. So yes, I'm single. Yes, I've got maybe less of a social life, but this is my path, no one else's path, and I'm happy. So I'm posting about a path that I don't feel overworked ever. Like I feel I'm doing what I love. So if someone's telling me, yeah, you shouldn't work because it's tiring, it's not good to overwork, I'm saying, but I'm doing what I love. So who is anyone to tell me that I'm overworking? Because I'm not. So I think this is the thing, is to understand, this is why I don't really like social media sometimes, is it's hard to get that message every day across, which is why I try not to post too much, because I understand people might perceive it in a different way. But I'm always trying to say, like, just be on your path and never try not to compare. But when you can, take motivation when it matters to you.
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? Because something that you find empowering and motivating could be triggering for someone else. And that's always going to be the case, because think about people who are unemployed, for example. You know, I feel like if you were to post about work and how much you love it, and of course you do, but like not everyone is going to resonate with that.
There is a responsibility for the creator of that content to be mindful of how often they share. Like, I mean, I'm not going to share every single morning now, like I work out, unless it's like I'm a personal trainer, because maybe it's not productive. But at the same time, if someone is tired by it, they can mute, say, my stories for a week and then come back to, or they can unfollow me, you know? It's totally... Like, it's just Instagram, you know, it's not, it doesn't mean the person, if someone unfollows, doesn't mean they hate me. And I think no one should ever take it personal. I think it's just about, you know, you do you and let the person do them. And that's the beauty of social media, is we curate what we want to see, and it's always changing and it should change. But, to avoid that constant change, I do think the creator itself, like me, has to regulate how often we're talking about things, and also how real we're being, you know, how honest. I like to also show the negative. You know, I also like to show the failure as well as the success, not because I feel obliged to say it, but because I feel that there's a lesson to be learned from it that I want to spread to people as well.
Yeah, show both sides of it for sure. Yeah, social media really isn't that deep. But I was actually going to say, you don't need to hold that whole responsibility on your shoulders, basically. Like, I think you have a responsibility for sure. But at the same time, like, oh my gosh, if you thought every time you're about to post a story and you thought, okay, who's this going to trigger? Oh no, like feel that anxiety, then I think that's just going to cripple you. Like, there's no point.
That balance is quite hard. And I always say, you can never make anyone fully happy. Like, that's impossible. You know, I get 100 DMs that are positive and that one negative one. And that's why I'm always like, you know what? It's done. But if I feel like I want to post it, I'm going to do it.
Absolutely. You do that. Although, does that one negative comment play on your mind?
Sometimes if it's true, I mean, really true, like, you know it's true, and we are human, we make mistakes. I sometimes showcase sometimes the better things and I'm not always the most truthful, because I don't find it productive to do so, but maybe it can be caught out. It does get to me. So only when I hear it and I believe that they're right and I should have done something better, but I'll kind of transition that and focus on how do I correct it and make it more right, you know? If they're saying something about me being, you sound very condescending, and I really believe that maybe I was condescending, then I need to address that to myself and learn from that. But again, it kind of goes back to that whole failure thing. Like, how can I trick my brain to be like, okay, this is hard to hear. Try to take the positives from it, try to learn from it, but don't let it affect your day, because you cannot let it affect your day. But sometimes, I'll be honest, when I'm not that strong in my brain, I just try not to look at my messages, because it doesn't, maybe, you know, it doesn't help me and my mental health.
Yeah, it's also recognizing like the days that you can't handle it and just staying away. Like, I've started actually just deleting it off my phone now. So like 2-3 days a week, I'll just delete it and just not go on it. Or sometimes I think I've heard a lot of people say that they delete it off their phone and then they use it on their laptop, which stops them from staying on it sometimes.
That's a really good way sometimes. But I do this. I did this thing with my friend. It was really good. I don't do it anymore, but I think I've been accustomed to it. We used to do in France a competition where it was like, we used to show each other a screenshot of our screen time. Whoever had the less screen time would win and get paid €20 from the other person. So this was like our way of to like minimize our screen time in the week. Sounds silly. I do that now with gym. I have a thing with my friend. If we both don't do 4 times a week, some kind of gym exercise, we have to pay each other £20. So it sounds trivial, but it really does work sometimes, especially when you do it with a friend that's going to hold you to it. And the screen time game, I think, is a really good one, because not only does it make you kind of monitor your usage of your phone and minimize it, but it also makes you realize and look at that number. And sometimes you're shocked and you're saying, wait, I did not spend 5 hours on Instagram today, did I? And that's important to do and monitor and kind of fix, because we need to not be so addicted to our phones and our apps.
Definitely. That's not silly at all, because I think my screen time went up to like 12 hours a day once. And I was just like, this is crazy. This is like most of my waking day. And it's also partly because obviously like we do everything on a screen. What stuff do you do when you're trying to stay away?
So I do a lot of like the gym part is a big thing for sure. Like working out and sometimes doing twice a day if I can, it keeps me occupied. The funny thing is I'm not even like a big gym freak, so I do it a lot, but I just kind of maintain. I should be in a much better body shape than I should, than the matter I talk about it. But yeah, no, definitely exercise, running, walking. The other thing I do a lot is, I'm not really someone who watches a lot of TV, but I like to like do that amongst doing something else. So like I put like a Netflix show on while maybe, yeah, like painting or something. I do a lot of art. I love art. Things like yoga. I have like this this kind of paper tablet thing that's not an iPad, but it's like a paper kind of form of tablet. So it's got no kind of screen, but it does save all your notes. So I use that a lot, and I do a lot of my brainstorming on there, a lot of my work on there. So I'll just take that with a green tea or matcha, go to my like bedroom and just literally spend 3 hours brainstorming. So I'm not on an actual screen, but I'm actually not using paper either. So that's something I would recommend people to do. It's called Remarkable.
I think I've seen it somewhere. It does ring a bell.
Definitely. I got an ad from it, and then I bought it from an ad, and then I've been using it every day since I got it. So yeah, definitely really good purchase.
Yeah, it's probably better than the blue light that we see. I've actually started reducing the blue light. So you can get an app on your Mac, if you have a Mac, called Flux. And I use that a lot just to kind of keep it easy on the eyes before bed as well. I can't not look at a screen 3 hours before bed. Like, it's just not going to happen, because what would I do for those 3 hours?
Yeah, honestly, but that is true. I would say that 3 hours before I sleep, it would be hard to not have had an interaction with a screen. For sure.
Exactly. Reading helps, I think. I try to read wherever I can before bed. Yeah,
definitely. Reading, I need to get back into that a bit more, because I do miss it. But my mind kind of tells me, like, I sounds really bad, but like, I'd rather actually listen to like a podcast. And I like to do two things at a time, but mainly because I guess my day is so busy that I have so much work that never ends. I always feel like I need to do two things at one time if I'm doing something. So can I work out and listen to a podcast? Or can I walk and listen to an audiobook, you know? But maybe I need to get back into just the simple things of just spending 6 hours reading a book, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, whatever works for you, right? Like, I think we're adapting as we go. And to be honest, even like the paper tablet thing is such an upgrade from staring at an iPad just before bed. So yeah, I think there's been some really good tips in there. Thank you for sharing that. And it's honestly, I feel like I know you so much better now. Like, I understand a bit more about like how you manage yourself while running these three companies, which honestly, for one, just a normal human being, how is that even possible? You know, but it's amazing that you're managing to do it. And like, what is the plan for your brands, for you in the next 2 years?
So I definitely, my bigger vision is to have like my own conglomerate, whether it's like a Coty or a L'Oreal, but basically that pioneers kind of creating beauty brands that really have a mission of doing more than just the products. So a true giving back, or a CSI, a corporate social intention that's really authentic to the founder's roots. So I'm on a mission to create brands with different founders. So the first one would be my sister. The next one, I have another partner that I'm currently working with, an influencer, and that'll be like her brand. So that's something that we're working on. So I want to do like every 2 years, you know, a new brand, and do it properly so I can grow it to a bigger scale and spread that message correctly. So that's my vision. It's a long-term vision, but I want to be like my father, but build brands instead of, he normally licenses and buys them. I want to build them from the beginning. And then more kind of personally, to be really honest, I do kind of want to settle down now. I want to get in a relationship. I mean, my last girlfriend was like 8 years ago. So I've been single for a very long time, and pretty much I would say I've never really had a relationship properly. So yeah, now 27 soon, I need to start thinking about that. And I do need to put a bit more emphasis on it, because I realize it doesn't just come like that. So yeah, I think I have some personal goals for sure, but I definitely have a larger vision for the brand. And obviously Fable and Mane, I want to grow it to more countries and more products, kind of spread the mission and be the Thatcher, if you will, for eye beauty and grow Indian wisdom around the world.
Well, more power to you, because I'm sure you're going to do it and probably exceed your own expectations. My last question to you is, I wanted to know from you, Akash, what do you have strong game in? And tell me one thing that maybe you could have stronger game in.
So I think my strongest game is I'm a people's person. I think that comes from two approach. One is I really find it easy and I feel confident connecting to people from all different cultures, all different backgrounds. And even if I don't have anything in common, how I can empathize with them. I think also growing up, that helped me, you know, going back to our story of being in the whole kind of cultural kind of box growing up, I've always yearned to understand people better and really connect with everyone and understand their story without being confrontational. So I think, yeah, I'm a people's person. That also translates to hopefully me being a good manager, and I love managing people and growing people and understand that there's no hierarchy, we're all the same team. So that's definitely one thing I would say I'm strong in. But my thing I need to be stronger in is, I would say, even though I'm very good at preaching about it, I need to be a little bit more thicker skinned. I'm very sensitive as a human. I just am. And it doesn't help that I'm on a very kind of open platform and with my following and social media, and I'm doing all these podcasts and everything and talking very openly. I do find it very, very difficult to, I'm not very confident, I guess, even though it may look like I am, but I'm not. So I need to like care a bit less what people think, and sort of be very proud of what I've done and not ever second guess myself, and deal with negativity in a sort of, don't hide from it. But you know, if I get a negative email, usually my first approach is, I can't read it. Can someone else read it? So I need to just get a bit more thicker skin. I think my sister is very good at that. So that's where I need to learn from my sister, is to be a bit less sensitive and a bit more confident. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think to your last point, I was thinking the other day, what would the world be like if nobody doubted themselves? Like the places we would go and the things we would do, right? Like we hold ourselves back so much. Everyone does. It's just unbelievable. Like, where does that come from and why?
I think it's just human nature. So maybe I'm preaching something that I shouldn't change, and maybe it's hard to change, but yeah, I need to, you know, for myself, work on it. And I think everyone will relate that has the same, you know, hidden, the inner demons of it's not productive overall.
Absolutely. Well, I just wanted to say once again, thank you so, so much for coming on today and sharing your story and just being so, so raw and open with us. Because honestly, like for me, I could previously, before having this conversation, I saw your social media and the work that you've done. And I've, to be honest, it's just such a mystery. Like, how does he do so much? So it's been an absolute privilege to hear kind of the other side of it, and sometimes the doubts and the everyday struggle and the slog, because it sometimes is, right? So thank you. And I appreciate you so much. And I'm such a fan.
It means a lot. And well, thanks for having me and for also creating this podcast, which I think is such an important thing today. I've been listening to everything that you've been doing, and I'm a fan of you, and I can't wait to know and get to know you better. It's a shame that during Imperial, we weren't as connected as, but now, you know, everything happens for a reason. So now it's just the beginning of hopefully a very beautiful friendship.
Oh, I love that. Definitely. Well, thank you. And just for everyone listening, please, please check out all the work Akash is doing. Akash, would you be able to share your social media handles and for your brand and for yourself as well?
Yeah, sure. So my Instagram is my surname's Mehta_A. So it's Mehta_A. And my brand with my sister is called Fable and Main. So like Fable, like Story and Main. So you can check us out in all the relevant handles. But thank you again so much, Mitali, for having me. It means a lot.